Anarcho-capitalism has won in Argentina. Libertarian chainsaw guy Javier Milei just won a decisive electoral victory, bigger than most people expected. What do libertarians think about that? We're going to talk about it today. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm your host, Peter Suderman, and today I am joined by my colleagues, Matthew Welch, Nick Gillespie, and special Reason Roundup newsletter writer extraordinaire, Liz Wolf. Everybody, welcome to the show. Liz, you wrote about Milei's victory for us in the Reason Roundup this morning. Tell us just briefly, what happened? Why does it matter?
So I dispute the characterization of Milei as an anarcho-capitalist,
mostly because he has used that term, is my understanding.
Mostly because of the amount of central bank control that Argentina currently has, which I'll get to in a second. But I mean, this is huge news. This is a lot better than a lot of people were predicting. Basically, Milei, when he came into office about 2 years ago, was in charge of making a ton of really aggressive cuts. And, you know, the voters asked for that. But some of these cuts were extraordinarily painful. And in a place that has just historically had handout after handout given to the people, so much public sentiment in favor of Peronism, the fact that Milei's aggressive public spending cuts have been able to make it through, I mean, a lot of people thought that this was going to result in massive backlash. It's worth noting, especially because our own president doesn't seem to know, that this was not a referendum on Milei himself technically. This was a legislative election, but his party won more than 40% of the vote. Basically, more than 30% of seats in parliament is what would have registered as sort of a victory for Milei. So the fact that he, you know, majorly exceeded those expectations is absolutely huge. I mean, I would basically look at this as the Argentine people decided to stay the course. You know, there will be a lot of short-term pain with getting Argentine inflation under control and actually getting to a place of greater fiscal solvency. Milei is, I think, headed down the right path, but that's not to say he's making, you know, every single correct decision or that the people will, you know, greet all of these decisions favorably. So I do think there is an issue that's going to have to be contended with at some point, which is the fact that there's such little investor confidence and public confidence in the peso. You know, right now, it's been basically a floating exchange rate. You know, the peso floats freely within a band, and the central bank intervenes in the market if the exchange rate sort of approaches or exceeds certain limits. You know, it's really kind of open season for speculators. There's a lot of vulnerability and instability in this. And so floating the peso more fully and Milei deciding to have a central bank that's intervening less would be the path to longer term stability here. So it remains to be seen whether Milei is actually going to do that.
Yeah, so the currency is obviously at the center of a lot of this, in particular what's been called a bailout. I called it a bailout last week on the podcast. We talked about this. There's a $20 billion kind of a currency exchange that has been floated by the Trump administration and you know, to support Milei and his policies in Argentina. Nick, last week when we talked about that, you came out very strongly, bigly, you might even say, against that sort of quasi-bailout loan, currency exchange, whatever you want to call it. Does this in some ways vindicate Trump's approach? Does this change your mind in any way?
No, it doesn't change my mind. I'm happy that Milei won or that his party won because he is going in the right direction and it might be a bellwether, not just for Argentina or South America, but hopefully for North America. I would love to see somebody, become the leader of America and cut government rather than spending. I just saw a tweet from Thomas Massey. I think we spent $7 trillion in fiscal year 2025. So, you know,
trillion here,
go.
Trillion there. Eventually,
yeah,
it's
it really
real
doesn't
money.
Matter. But for me, and I hope that Milei follows through with his early campaign promise of dollarizing the Argentine economy. That is the way forward, and it would stop the currency fluctuations and devaluation, and just hyperinflation that is Argentina's curse.
Matt Welch, are there perhaps any lessons that other countries, say in Europe or maybe even here in North America, in the United States, someone like Trump, who appears to support Milei, who sees him as an ally, who sees him as a reformist who is moving things in the right direction, are there lessons that the United States government or other governments could learn from Milei's policies and their effects, as well as from this pretty stunning electoral victory?
I mean, policies, yes. I would love, I don't know, the incoming mayor of New York City to have Malay's idea about what to do with housing supply and rental prices.
You don't think Curtis Sliwa is going to change housing policy?
He's a restrictionist, Nick.
He is.
The red chapeau was blocking the Malay-like
the beret, man. Come on, he's signaling to his Al-Qaeda masters.
People just don't hate rats enough to vote for Curtis Sliwa.
At any rate, so on policy, yeah, there's definitely some lessons. I think the thing that we're talking about right now is politics. The real shocker here, and why I'm very, very excited about this result, is that the recent past, last 30, 40 years, is just littered with the skeletons of harsh free market reformers who face elections 2 years later, or whose party faces elections 2 years later. There's a reason why we don't talk about Leszek Balcerowicz as someone who is an incredible political figure in Poland. That's because he did shock therapy, and everyone's like, no, God, what are you doing? That hurts. And that's generally what happens. And people who, politicians, what they usually do is they do what Nick's dear friend Václav Klaus did in early stages of the post-Velvet Revolution, is say, okay, we're going to be super free market. Oh, and also we're just going to keep, you know, all these prices locked in ember because we need to win elections. Malay hasn't seemed to do that too much. His list of reforms that he's gone through is really impressive, especially considering how small his legislative support has been. And in this election, he effectively tripled his party's poll in parliament. That's insane. That's incredibly heartening. And so if there's a political lesson, is that maybe just go absolutely bananas, dress up as Nick Gillespie, and get your chainsaw out. That could be something that works. I think as opposed to sort of this Emmanuel Macron kind of really soft, half-hearted centrism that isn't really for anything. It's just like, we don't want the real bad guys to come in. I don't think that's really where the beating heart of polities are right now, for better or for worse, in 2025. And so maybe this is a way forward. I have a hard time imagining that American conditions will be so bad that we will need and respond to in the same way as a Malay. Hopefully we can get someone who's a little bit like that, at least, before they get that bad.
Hey, Matt, if I just real quick a button, because Matt is attacking me personally, and yes, and I'm here for it. But Václav Klaus, when he became the head of the Czech, I guess Czechoslovakia briefly, or the Czech Republic, whichever. But he did an interview with Reason where he said, I want a libertarianism without adjectives. But I think you will agree, Matt, that he ended up being an adjective without libertarianism.
In fact, he was that already by 1992, but it took a while for the rest of the world to catch up.
To that point, Matt, I do feel like some people have thrown out, in a slightly tongue-in-cheek manner, thankfully, this idea of, like, is democracy, in fact, the trouble with instituting free market reforms in Latin America? Just meaning, basically, when you have these referendums that happen every 2 years on policies like Malay's, where you really do have to stay the course, it makes sense why the people who are sort of temporarily disgruntled, who want the cozy embrace of the Peronist handouts that they've grown accustomed to, it makes sense why they would revolt. But it's really kind of an extraordinary blessing that this time we're seeing them actually committing to Malay.
Well, part of this is because he's actually shown some real results. I mean, so Matt mentioned shock therapy, which is what his program has been called here, and that has involved sharply devaluing the peso, unifying exchange rates, right? And this is going to close the budget gap. He actually produced the first balanced budget in more than a decade there. He reduced energy subsidies, and he fired tens of thousands of public sector employees. And all of this has, like I said, it balanced the budget, and then it is also, and I think this is the more significant thing, reduced inflation. 2 years ago, inflation in Argentina was 200%. And now it's 32%. Now that's really high. That's much higher than it is here in the United States. But that is a dramatic, dramatic drop in inflation. You combine that with the budget reforms. And I think that has been, like showing those results has been key to getting the a kind of electoral buy-in here. At the same time, I wonder, Liz, is there a kind of a weightlifting metaphor metaphor that you can apply to this, which is like when you start weightlifting, you get what are called newbie gains, right? The first time you start a program, if you stick with it, if you haven't been weightlifting before, you're going to gain a lot of strength really quickly. And then it gets harder after that. Are these kind of newbie gains for Argentina, where he did his program. He's there 3 days a week. He's doing 5x5s. But after the first year or so, it gets a lot harder to build more.
This is the most toxic form of mansplaining, right? Like mansplaining gains to a weak pregnant woman.
I feel my estrogen levels rising. Yeah.
Like, yeah, I have not been working out in a while. I'm not even sure I follow you at this point, Peter. No, I mean, I think to some degree what you're saying is correct. The thing that I keep thinking about is just how a lot of the, you know, Argentina is basically this place of special interest groups, you know, whether it's regulatory bodies, whether it's unions, which I think it would shock American audiences recognizing how much power unions have in Argentine politics compared to ours and the degree to which they just loom large in the cultural imagination. Milei has done an extraordinary job of really taking his chainsaw to some of these groups. I was reading about the yerba mate regulatory body, which yerba mate is basically coffee beans, right? Like it's a caffeinated drink. Under no circumstances do you need a regulatory body. However, you know, when there are times of overproduction, these mate growers, these farmers will use their political power and basically say, actually, no, we need a regulatory commission to protect our ability to be in our industry and to keep prices sort of artificially, you know, the way they were, as opposed to allowing new entrants into it. Milei has absolutely no tolerance for this type of crap, right? And so he slashed that. And a lot of people were wondering, I mean, the mate farmers are sort of a silly example, but he's done that across so many different industries. People were wondering going into last night, going into this election, whether all of those people were going to revolt. And I think it's actually a very beautiful thing. I was reading some sound bites from different farmers, and a lot of them were like, we don't really like Milei all that much, but he's better than the alternatives. And it's like, that's actually a very useful admission. And I hope that they continue to realize that even though he's not necessarily serving their best interests, there is a little bit of a long game that you do have to play when you have been screwed over by Peronist policies for as many decades as the Argentine people have.
I love the yerba mate regulatory body angle to this. Like, that's so insane. You wouldn't believe it. Except for the fact that, of course, in the United States, we had a tea regulatory body that took decades upon decades to shut down, even after people had agreed. This was totally outdated and useless. Eric Boehm did a great story for us on that. Nick, I just want you to close us out here on this. Like, this is good news for libertarianism. This is good news for governance in Argentina. Maybe it will even be good news for governance elsewhere if people can see this as a model. But like, does this, we hear constantly that like there's no real libertarians, right? When you look at the chart, like the surveys, it's like everybody wants, big government economic policies and social conservatism. That's where the real action in politics is. But does this electoral victory where people actually voted for the policies after having seen them in effect show that libertarian free market economics built around cutting government can be popular?
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's important to recognize that it's not anarcho-capitalism. It's libertarian. Libertarian is an adjective. It's not a noun. It's directional. It is not absolute. He's moving in the right direction, you know, and he's moving in the direction of more economic freedom. And broadly speaking, there's some issues on this, more personal freedom. And that is a powerful set of policies. And then you also need a narrative around it. You know, Liz was kind of alluding to this throughout. You know, he, if nothing else, Milei is the counter narrative to the last 70 years of Argentine politics, which is that some, you know, a big daddy is going to take care of you. And that daddy can be a woman sometimes or whatever, but, you know, they're going to take care of you. And that, you know, so it's the mix of policies and the results they yield plus the narrative. And that's actually something in an American context. This is what I think has mostly gone missing over the last decade, is a libertarian narrative that actually helps to explain policies. People in America know work. But that is being kind of occluded by the bitter tribalism since Trump.
Well, now they have a big dog daddy. He's got all these mastiffs. Love him. That's my favorite thing about Milei is the giant dogs. All right, let's move ourselves toward an advertisement. We'll be back. This show is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Let me ask you a question. Do you trust your internet provider to respect your privacy? There's good reason not to. Depending on where you live, ISPs may be required to keep logs of your online activity. In the US, ISPs can legally sell your browsing history for profit. Good news is, you don't have to trust your ISP as long as you use ExpressVPN. Everyone needs ExpressVPN. Without it, a whole lot of third parties can see every website that you visit, even in incognito mode. Those third parties include your internet service provider, your mobile network provider, the admins of your Wi-Fi network, your school, your boss, your parents, whoever that might be. ExpressVPN reroutes 100% of your traffic through secure, encrypted servers. That means third parties can't see your browsing history. ExpressVPN is the best. It's easy to use, it hides your IP address, and it works on so many different devices. Phones, laptops, tablets, and more, so you can stay private on the go. ExpressVPN is rated number one by top tech reviewers like CNET and The Verge. Trust me, if you're someone who doesn't want third parties looking at your online activity, like sometimes me, you need ExpressVPN. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/roundtable. That's expressvpn.com/roundtable to find out how you can get up to 4 extra months. Once again, that is expressvpn.com/roundtable. Okay, let's check in on our imperial president. So the situation in Washington looks about like this. Democrats are useless. The government is shut down. Mike Johnson, the head of the Republican Party and the House Speaker of the House, is a pushover who is basically keeping the House out of session so that it cannot exert influence over politics right now, which kind of means that Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, not King, is the federal government. Not literally King, but he's basically the only person right now with the will or the power to act in Washington. That means that there's just a whole bunch of stuff going on, and it's all running through Trump. And I actually want to start with Trump's dust up with Canada over trade and a clip of Ronald Reagan saying that, maybe tariffs aren't so great. Nick, what do you think about all this? What does this tell you about Donald Trump and about the state of trade policy in the United States right now?
Trade policy is under attack, under legal attack by a lot of people, and many of Trump's tariffs are almost certainly going to be invalidated because of the way that they were put into place. His response to the Reagan clip that came out of an Ontario political ad where it was basically Reagan extolling the virtues of free trade and of getting rid of protectionism and tariffs. Trump's response was, it's AI, it's fake. He does not know his history. Where he does have a leg to stand on is that Reagan, like all American presidents, used tariffs strategically. But what's most important is that Reagan, and in the radio address that that ad was taken from and that Trump was responding to and claiming was made up, he is actually talking about Smoot-Hawley and about protectionism after the Wall Street collapse that kicked off the Great Depression. Reagan is extremely ideologically motivated by free trade. He helped put into place what became NAFTA eventually. It was actually the Canadian prime minister was the one who held it. But, Trump and Reagan couldn't be more different on the belief in trade policy and the trajectory of what should happen. According to JP Morgan, at the end of last year, the effective weighted tariff rate on goods coming into America was 2.3%. In August, it was 15.8%. Trump doesn't want that to go away. He wants to continue to use tariffs so that people have to kiss his ring, either coming into the country or coming out. And it's American, consumers who end up paying for those goods, 15.8% rather than 2.3% on imports. But also, and this is key to Reagan's understanding of free trade, ultimately, our economy and our jobs disappear if we just insist on protectionism, protectionism, protectionism.
Yeah, this is going to cost American consumers tens of billions of dollars, if not more than that. And the justification is, well, it's an emergency, except in this case, the justification seems to be Trump got butt hurt because of this ad that he thought was AI, which is pretty rich after his own AI, excursions here.
That was real. The one where he was flying the plane and dumping shit on protesters. Yeah, that was real. That was an AI, Peter.
I mean, I guess he knows from AI here. But Matt Welch, what does this tell us about the kind of legal regime under which Trump is operating, and with the tariffs, but also with a lot of other things where everything is an emergency and that justifies absolutely anything he wants to do?
And he's acting incredibly recklessly with his public statements, considering that these issues, particularly with tariffs, are up in front of the Supreme Court as we speak. And that's not a time to like obviously be doing it because you're mad about an ad that's running during the World Series in which the Blue Jays are playing. Like, that's really bad. That's a bad justification for your national emergency tariff. It's just clearly not.
It is true, though. The Blue Jays dropped that second game since he struck back, Matt.
That is true. He's going to make the L.A. Dodgers great again or something. It speaks to the kind of disease, not just in the kind of Trumpian tariff worldview. And let's just underline a little bit what Nick was alluding to before. That jump in tariffs has never been done before in American history. Like, the Smoot-Hawley tariff did not raise tariffs year over year to that remarkable a degree. As a percentage time, at least five times, 500% is the increase over a year in tariffs. That's crazy town. We really haven't tried that experiment before. And Trump is lucky enough, I suppose, that America is wealthy enough that we can kind of absorb it, or have been able to absorb it somewhat over this time. But to see the people out there, the kind of like Twitter conservatives parsing every Reagan thing, looking for some bit of evidence, which just kind of you can look and find one or two things if you look at it with a certain look on your face, being completely historically ignorant about what Ronald Reagan was trying to do. And part of the reason why that the climate is different and the way that we talk about it is different is that Reagan operated in a time he didn't have legislative majorities. Democrats ran Congress for all of his presidency. The average tariff rate was basically flat under Reagan. It was around 3.4% throughout most of his presidency, unlike people who whose presidencies coincided with pretty big dramatic drops like Bill Clinton, like Richard Nixon and Harry Truman and some other people. He didn't really have it. But what he did was, for 20 years before that and then during his presidency, which those of us who are of a certain vintage remember, he was constantly talking about it. He wanted a free trade zone from the tip of South America to the Arctic Circle, and was hoping that everybody's border would be like the American-Canadian border, not a place to keep people out, but a place to meet and to gather and exchange things. And this is just so well known. It's so obvious, so historical. And the people who've twisted themselves into pretzels because they're afraid not even of Donald Trump, but of Donald Trump's fans, are like trying to come up with excuses that Ronald Reagan was some kind of protectionist. It's a bad look, people. And one of the good things about not just Reagan, but all of the previous generations of presidents up until some point, I don't know exactly when we're going to draw that line, had some respect for the fact that Congress was at least had a strong role in the setting of policies, even if those presidents were constantly negotiating to have more authority to negotiate tariff deals themselves.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why we may be able to absorb some of Trump's tariff regime, is something that economists have talked about, and it's actually kind of hard to track, though, is that there are all these exceptions and exemptions that Trump is just personally handing out based on his whims or his sense that, oh, this is an important industry or an important company, and we wouldn't want to mess with that. And so we have this tariff regime that is where tariffs are quite high, but there are a ton of exceptions and exemptions that Trump is personally doling out, which makes the whole thing, among other things, kind of like difficult to do business in that environment, because if you don't have an in with the White House, you're not going to get that exemption. But also because it's really difficult to figure out even what's going on or what's going to happen. There's so much uncertainty here. And so to do business in this environment, I mean, it's just kind of maddening. But there's other places where Trump is acting like a king, where Trump is just sort of making up rationales for things he wants to do, you know, like the oceans, where he's just taking out drug boats and maybe moving, you know, aircraft carrier groups towards Latin America so we can, I don't know, overthrow a government. Maybe it seems like that's a possibility here. Right. Like, this is something that is happening where there is a lot of speculation that Trump is building up to a completely unauthorized war in Venezuela, Liz, and his administration in this base case isn't even saying, well, here is a specific emergency we can point to. They're just sort of waving around the words narco-terrorists. This seems really illegal to me. And also, not just illegal, it seems like it is a betrayal of the idea that we heard so often, which is that Trump is the peace president, the president you want to vote for if you don't want any more foreign wars.
Yeah, I struggle with this. I am of two minds here, and I am open to being to having my mind changed. The first thing that I really have been grappling with is that in terms of this actually being a narco-trafficking route for the types of things that Pete Hegseth and J.D. Vance and Donald Trump are claiming, I mean, we're not seeing a ton of fentanyl and a ton of heroin coming in through Venezuela in particular. That's not really the vector by which these drugs enter by and large. So that claim sort of falls apart. I also, you know, struggle like any good libertarian would with the question of like, these strikes are extrajudicial. You know, good evidence has not been presented, at least to the American people or to Congress, that these types of strikes should be authorized, that Trump is operating on good intelligence. I mean, we just are sort of flying blind in terms of our ability to assess, you know, what's going on here and whether or not we're killing innocent people or narco traffickers. And, you know, even if he were killing narco traffickers who are legitimately carrying drugs into this country, he's still not doing so in a way that's authorized by Congress, right? So, you know, that's my big, huge libertarian caveat. Like, I understand all of those things and I take all of those things seriously. Don't strike
Where's
me
the
out
butt?
Of the water, Nick.
It's coming. What's, no, but where are we going with this?
The thing I have been struggling with a little bit is every Venezuelan I end up talking to is basically like, oh, you don't know the extent to which Maduro is in bed with the narco traffickers. And you don't know the extent to which Colombian President Gustavo Petro is in bed with the narco traffickers. You do not understand from your American perspective the degree to which these are not, you know, heads of state as we typically understand them, but rather these heads of cartels. And that's the better way of understanding how they operate. And then you see some of the statements that keep coming out from Petro, from Maduro, that are basically trying to manipulate the American media, I think, into making it so the American people are opposed to this and trying to sort of understand what type of messaging will land best with the American people. And I see both Petro and Maduro really trying to play a press game here, a PR game, which of course they do. That makes perfect sense. But at least when I think about the 7 or 8 million people who fled Venezuela in the last 10 years, when I think about the, you know, extraordinary number, I think it's at least 20,000, probably many more, of extrajudicial killings that the Maduro regime has undertaken in the last few years. I mean, we are talking about profoundly evil people, in my view. And yet it is not clear that attempting to, you know, remove them in this way is a prudent or legal or appropriate use of U.S. power. But I really do struggle with, like, I feel like Americans do sort of consistently downplay the degree of criminal badness that is going on, specifically linked to the Colombian and Venezuelan regimes.
Yeah, I'll add to that. Just if I may, I'll just add to that that the Venezuelans I know, and you know, that goes into the low double digits. So it's a lot of people, but all of them, to a person, says that they want the Maduro regime to be taken out through any means necessary, and this includes a lot of libertarian or libertarian leaning Venezuelans.
Exactly.
Having said that, I think this is where. You know, this is where libertarian principles are most important because, yeah, we could do it, right? It would be easy. Like, we could just bomb things. We wouldn't even have to put that many troops in or any troops in or any Marines in. And we could knock out the government. We could disband the army. And then we could let democracy flower. This, I think, is a powerful challenge or a reminder that every time that we've thought we we were able to do that, it does not go that way. And this is one of the reasons why going through a due process, not just for like individual fishermen who are being blown to smithereens, right? In the Caribbean are, you know, they need to be treated differently, but we need to figure out a way if we want to exert pressure to get rid of one of the most awful regimes in human history, certainly currently active, we have to do it a different way than trying to do it through military power.
Yeah, you have to have a process for this. even if, like, let's take it all for granted that Maduro is the absolute worst, is just a murderous, drug involved, like a horrible person, the worst person you can imagine, that his regime is basically a drug cartel regime, that like every terrible thing that's said about this person and this regime is totally true, that it's as bad as you can imagine. You still have to have a process for the United States president to go in and wage a war and, you know, and overthrow a government. Because even if it's right this one time, even if it works this one time, what is the next president going to do with the power to do this unilaterally? With what is the next president going to do with the power to do this without congressional buy-in, without any kind of process? You don't want to give a president that kind of power. And yes, I know this power has been growing. It didn't just start with Trump. Trump is just adding another layer on top of the layer, the sediment of unchecked power that has been growing in the executive branch for decades now. But still, you got to stop it at some point.
The new wrinkle is that there isn't any even sort of flimsy derivative authorization for the use of military force on this, which after 9/11, we had two different authorizations of force that you could sort of point to anytime you were tackling a Muslim somewhere. And now it's sort of like, oh, well, it's some combination of we don't like illegal immigrants and drug cartels, plus we don't like illegal immigrants and drug cartels. Skill points for Marco Rubio to navigate Trump's, anti-war tendencies or intervention skeptical tendencies. He had to portray this in such a way that Trump would go along with it. But I think that he was always going to go along with it. Trump's a Jacksonian in foreign policy. He's irritable. He wants to wave a big stick. And my presumption is, especially hearing people like Rick Scott from Florida talking over the weekend, talking to Thor Halvorsen personally 6 weeks ago, when he was saying, like, in the next 30 days, you're going to see a lot of pressure on people inside the government and on generals. They're going to feel physically uncomfortable and persuaded to leave. And he was seeing it with that sort of special tone of voice that made it seem like, well, maybe let's pay attention the next 30 to 60 days. And we have seen kind of a lot of that. I think that Trump wants to do regime change on the cheap. He doesn't want boots on the ground, but he does want to say, yeah, maybe we're doing CIA. And yeah, we're absolutely murdering people whenever we feel like it, which is almost a direct quote at this point from whenever he's asked about it, because that adds a level of uncertainty, which he finds to be useful in this. I think just like the kind of regime change things that we've done in Latin America for the last 100 plus years on the cheap, using the CIA, using
it always works out well.
Matt,
who's leading Nicaragua? Didn't we have a total victory there?
Yeah.
Is it Oliver North?
Yeah. The next president is always worrying. It's this one that I'm kind of worried about right now, and what he's doing and the kind of shrugs that he's getting in Congress, with the exception of your spare Rand Paul, who pointed out in the pages of Reason something that's not insignificant, which is that 25% of the suspected drug ships that are interdicted by the Coast Guard don't have any drugs. If that's the error rate, we're doing a lot of murders out there. We've bombed 10 boats so far. So that is reason to suspect that we might have killed innocent people that we could have just stopped and searched anyways and chose not to. It's bad.
And yet, to push back on that the tiniest bit, we did have all of those headlines, including one that I wrote via Reason Roundup about, you know, is the Trump administration in fact killing, you know, bombing innocent fishermen? And then lo and behold, 2 days later, 3 days later, information emerges about this guy's narco trafficking links, which is not to say that the innocent guy, innocent fisherman who was dragged up, who ended up having
a criminal record.
Three out of four people deserve it.
I'm not saying we should overweight that evidence. I am just saying, like, it looks pretty awkward from a PR perspective.
There's the sort of straw man that we do, like, the asshole dictators over there are playing the U.S. media. Well, first of all, they don't have any other choice. but second of all, I'm not the one who's apologizing for goddamn Maduro stealing elections. I'm not the one who's doing any of this stuff. I'm the one who's saying the government that I pay taxes to is murdering people. Some of them might be bad guys. That's not the standard. We got to do a little bit better than that standard. And I'm not persuaded by, like, well, look, they were a bad guy. We still murdered them wrongly.
Well, we don't murder narco traffickers. Those are criminal cases. So, you know, we should be arresting them if we think they're narco traffickers.
Since when are you against narco trafficking, Nick? This is
I'm not. I'm in favor of it, but I am, you know, given the increase in tariffs, I'm growing my own cocaine now, Matt. Yeah.
Nick's you know, like, we need to get the Coast Guard to board the boats, and then we can get whatever's on those boats. Like, that error rate is actually very unfortunate, because we, in fact, need to get those drugs to New York City. No, I mean,
I feel like Tiffany Trump should be given, this should be her special portfolio, because all the other Trump kids have something going on.
All right, speaking of working the media, I want to move on just to and cover one more thing here, which is this other thing that is happening, which is that there is yet another giant media merger in the air. It is Paramount Skydance is looking at maybe buying Warner Brothers, which owns, among other things, Batman, which is what I care about a lot, but also CNN. Which I think our president cares about quite a bit. And so far, Warner Brothers has rejected several tender offers from the David Ellison camp, who owns Paramount Skydance. But what is happening is that the Trump administration and the people involved close to the deal are saying basically, well, there, you shouldn't even consider any other suitor at any price, even if it's higher than the one that David Ellison offers, because the Trump administration is not going to approve it, because the Trump administration is going to block any merger, any buyer, except maybe Paramount Skydance, and thus David Ellison, whose father is Larry Ellison. And look, to be clear, I don't oppose David Ellison owning Warner Brothers in any way or oppose media mergers in any way, but this seems kind of gross. And it seems like it's all feeding on itself, right? Like, these things are all kind of combining to produce a situation where a lot of people, maybe even in the media, have an incentive not to call Trump out on his bullshit when he says, hey, that Reagan ad must be AI, it must be fake, it must be cheating, because they know that every deal that they want to do has to go through Donald Trump. Nick, what do you think about all of this? Does it seem like, what is the way that we get out of this and kind of put a check on Trump's king-like desires to sort of be involved in every transaction and manage all of this from the White House?
I think anything that makes it even less likely that I'll ever watch CNN again is a good thing. So I'm in favor of this.
Oh, all right.
I would defer to Liz because she was getting worked up, and I think we can work this back into the Venezuela Trump family empire.
Close this out,
things
Liz.
Like that.
Well, I think, unfortunately, this does prove that the conspiracy theorists were right, because this could possibly result in Barry Weiss being in charge of the entire media, right?
I mean no, the legacy media, the failing legacy media, like, you know?
Yeah.
To state the obvious, but apparently sometimes you got to say these things sometimes out loud. The president neither the president nor anybody in government should have a rat's ass worth of influence on who is head of who, what, which media company, whether we like that CEO and who's buying it and whatever. I remember when the rise of Trumpism began in 2015, their scare story in every case was, we don't want to turn out like Western Europe. Look at those horrible people in Western Europe doing all those things. And man, has he gone so Western Europe on so many different ways. Anytime a government changes hands in France, what happens? A lot of editors lose their jobs. Those shouldn't be related things. They increasingly are in this country. And it's pathetic. Congress shall make no law. You ask Nick what to do against it. Get rid of the FTC, get rid of the FCC, then the Department of Commerce, and get the government out of the business of micromanaging media mergers. What the fuck?
Yeah, we don't need a yerba mate board, and we don't need the FTC or the FCC either. All right, we are going to come back in just a moment with a listener question after this. The Reason Roundtable is sponsored by BetterHelp. So the days are getting shorter and they're getting darker, but that doesn't mean they have to be emotionally trying. This November, BetterHelp is encouraging everyone to reach out, to check in with friends, reconnect with loved ones, remind the people in your life that you're there. Call your mom, text a best friend, have coffee with an acquaintance that you just want to get to know a little bit better. Yes, sometimes this can be a little bit difficult. And just as it can take a little bit of courage to send that message or grab coffee with someone you haven't seen in a while, reaching out for therapy can feel a little bit trying too. But I promise it's worth it. And when you do, you'll wonder, why didn't I do this sooner? BetterHelp has quality therapists. They work according to a strict code of conduct. BetterHelp helps you connect with a therapist who fits your needs and your preferences. If you're not happy with your match, you can switch. Find a different therapist at any time from tailored recommendations. BetterHelp has over 30,000 therapists. It's the largest online therapy platform in the world. It serves over 5 million people globally. And it works with an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. So this month, don't wait to reach out. Whether you are checking in on a friend or reaching out to a therapist yourself, BetterHelp makes it easier to take that first step. Reason Roundtable listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/roundtable. That's betterhelp.com/roundtable. All right, we're going to take a question from a listener. Reminder, we love to answer all of your questions, many of them anyway. If you want us to answer yours, please send your short, succinct, pithy, and otherwise not very long question to podcasts@reason.com. That's podcasts@reason.com. This week's question comes from Rob, who writes, I often feel protesting is an exercise in futility. Protesting seems as though it makes people feel like they have done something, but it's largely performative. Do any of you find the No Kings rallies useful? How do you feel about protests in general? Nick, let's start with you.
I feel good about the No Kings rallies, which I went to the one in New York. I don't think it's, you know, earth shattering, and it's, you know, it's no, you know, bus boycott or anything like that, but it's a show of force, and I'm sure it's going to have an impact somewhere down the road. The Tea Party rallies, which Matt and I covered extensively for Reason in real time, those on some level were, you know, are paradigmatic of something that's very successful. You know, at least a dozen, maybe a couple dozen congressmen and senators were voted into office because of them, and then it kind of disappeared. So, you know, rallies or protest movements can be very successful and short-lived. They can also be much more important. I mean, the civil rights era was predicated upon extremely effective, highly public protests. So more power to them. You know, don't judge everything by, the most recent version of something.
Matt,
most protests. Most protest movements that are judged by history to have been successful, like the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King, the anti-communist movement in Central and Eastern Europe, were described at the time by people who hated equally what was being protested as being performative. Letter from Birmingham Jail is a letter to people who are accusing him of being performative. The feud between Václav Havel and Milan Kundera was like, I think performative might have even been in Kundera's letters, saying you're just being a show off and it's actually hurting the cause. Almost all protests are kind of meaningless. You're never going to really or rarely going to find like true insight at a political protest, as in my view. And at the same time, if the No Kings rallies, which I basically share Nick's point of view on, I'm happy. I don't like kings either. I don't like kingly-like behavior, and it's a good thing to protest against. If they were, imagine for a second, five times as big, so instead of 7 million, which is the reported number, regardless of whether that's true, they were 35 million or 10% of the population, that would be different. That's very tough. Huge protests like that can signal to regimes and, more, very importantly, to the police that and the military that support those and enforce the law for those regimes that they've lost the populace. That is an important message. It only comes out rarely, but it comes out sometimes. So it's not entirely useless to protest.
It'll be interesting to see if the rally in Hungary, and I'm sure, Matt, you were watching that while wearing that horrible Hungarian vest that you sometimes break out of mothballs for Reason events. But that was gigantic, where, you know, a bunch of dissidents were, you know, likening Orban to the communists invading in 1956, packed the square. I mean, that might have an impact.
And can only sneak out their photos, not through drones, which were outlawed, but by some, I think a Ryanair pilot snapped a picture overhead. Then you could see everybody on Hero Square. It was a huge, huge crowd.
Liz, this question uses the word performative kind of as an insult to say, therefore it doesn't mean anything. It's just about sort of signaling, right? Performative has become an insult. But I kind of think Matt and Nick are getting at something here, which is that sometimes performance in politics, in messaging, in the world of ideas, is in fact valuable. What do you think?
I mean, performance is speech, right? I think to some degree, we're all products of the times that we live in. And so, you know, Matt talks about the sort of impact of anti-communist movements. And, you know, one thing that just comes to my mind is I'm 29 years old. The only protest movements that I've really seen have been the pussy hats, which turned me off of the color pink for like forever. And now I don't even want to wear like winter hats, even when it's like,
how are you on knitting and crocheting? Like, is that also a problem now?
You know, like, you know, the Black Lives Matter protests, which very much turned into riots in a lot of places, which set, you know, our cities on fire.
Or I heard they were mostly peaceful.
Or yeah, they were very peaceful. The anti-Israel, you know, protesters who are shutting down the bridges that go into Manhattan all the time. I mean, when I look at the sort of protest movements that have been most formative in my short lifespan, I haven't really seen one that feels anything. It just always feels so aggressively hollow and very much like it's conducted by people who really have very little at stake, and I think who do a very poor job of articulating what they're actually advocating for and using sort of proper, appropriate tactics and good follow-through to actually see those things into reality. However, at the same time, the thing that always comes to mind here is like, it's easy to roast these people. It's all incredibly cringe. I love the tweets that are like, I'm so grateful our senior citizens got outside to enjoy an autumn day at the No Kings rally. However, there is this question of like, what is the mechanism by which these people are supposed to voice their extreme discontent at the Trump administration? And the thing that I keep coming back to is the fact that I find it so fucked up that we don't have like a Federalist Society equivalent, but on the left in this country. Because basically we're in a position now where judges are really the sort of stopgap, you know, attempting to adjudicate whether or not some of the actions that Trump is taking is legal or not. And, you know, we have a Federalist Society, which has historically been populated pretty much entirely by conservatives and a very aggressive conservative legal movement in this country, but we really do not have an equivalent on the left. And I think overall, our ability to staff our courts and our ability for people to feel well served by our courts would probably be bolstered if we had more of that. And I think ultimately courts are where we're going to see the checks on, you know, abuse of executive power. I don't think that these protesters are actually going to have much influence, but I really feel for them when they voice this concern that's like, Trump is doing something absolutely awful, and I'm worried that there's no mechanism by which we can actually stop him.
You know, if I may, that also, it's interesting though to talk about the courts, because the, you know, the old saying that the courts read the newspapers too, or, you know, the justices. Robert Bork started, I think it's slouching towards Gomorrah, with a memory of when he was working in the Reagan White House, I think, where protesters would walk by the White House in Congress and they would go and protest on the steps of the Supreme Court because that's where the action was. So in a way, it may not be new that the place to protest ultimately is the Supreme Court, because people recognize rightly that that's, you know, ultimately they're the deciderers, right? And they're going to be the deciderers in a bunch of issues. You know, almost everything that Trump has done, Peter, to bring it back to your beginning kind of general thesis statement about Trump as a king, he's acting like a king, but this isn't this isn't a kingdom. So that, I mean, I hope the Supreme Court, which is getting younger, which is good, and they've gotten rid of a couple of New Jersey people, also good, a little too Catholic for my taste, but like hopefully they're paying attention.
So I take your point about the kind of shallowness of a lot of the modern protests and sort of the ineffectiveness. But I want to push back just a little bit, or maybe ask you about a different type of protest that you might be a little bit more sympathetic to, Liz, which is a lot of pro-life protesters who have just made for decades now a habit of standing outside of abortion clinics and protesting. In some cases, yeah, some things have gotten out of hand, but a lot of it, the bulk of that protesting, it's not big mass protests in the way that we've seen with, you know, against Trump. It's not the pussy hats, and it's not No Kings, and it's not the big rallies we saw against Bush and the Iraq War. It's often just a few people who are there very regularly, and they kept that issue in the public eye, and have had some success actually in the courts over the last number of years here. And it seems to me like the pro-life movement, again, you know, I know we have different opinions about this on this podcast, right? And Liz, you are on the pro-life side of things. But the pro-life protesters are operating in a sort of different register than a lot of the protests that we see. And they've been actually reasonably effective just by being there and making it harder for people to forget there are people who oppose this and who want a different world.
I actually totally disagree with you. I am not a big fan of pro-life protesters either. I actually think, I'm curious to know how many minds are actually changed by the people who stand outside of abortion clinics. I feel as though it just creates these like very oppositional forces. I mean, to some degree, abortion clinics are always going to be these grounds for these mighty, mighty clashes between people who, feel their convictions very deeply. But I just don't know whether those protesters are actually the people who are keeping this type of thing in the public eye. I think it's the fact that it's actually an enduring facet of this issue, that public opinion has just been very aggressively divided on this. Generally speaking, it has held true. Pew and Gallup data confirm this over and over again, that most Americans support first trimester abortion rights and yet oppose second and third trimester abortion rights. I mean, people have a very strong and visceral sense of, what humanness looks like, and they don't totally agree on what that line is. But I think that the fact that it's remained such a polarizing thing and that holds true across generational lines very interestingly, I don't know if that's a testament to the power of pro-life protesters, really. I think it's a testament to the fact that it's a thorny issue that when people sort of sit alone with their conscience and their understanding of human development, they just consistently come down in really different places. I don't know if I like pro-life protesters. I think praying is more effective than protesting.
I'll also point out that that in the 80s and 90s there were massive pro-life protests, some of which became very violent. There were also a couple of murders of abortionists that really punctured the public protest movement and whatnot. But it's mostly a judicial strategy to overturn Roe v. Wade, which is something that Ruth Bader Ginsburg was in favor of. When Roe v. Wade was settled, she said this was a bad law, and they got their wish and it moved into legislative chambers, where things are it's very mixed. You have a lot of considered to be pro-life states like Kansas, where Operation Rescue, the most militant anti-abortion organization, is headquartered, and they voted in favor of maintaining pretty robust abortion rights. So it's complicated when you think about it in terms of protests. But Peter, I used to live around the corner on Bleecker Street from Planned Parenthood of New York.
Used to hold vigils, in fact.
Yeah,
my
every time I would go by there, and there would be people dressed in the Handmaid's Tale outfits sometimes, as well as people praying for people going in. And it was kind of, it should have been a Billy Joel song. Matt, I watched the Billy Joel HBO documentary, and I can't believe he didn't do a sequel to Scenes from an Italian Restaurant, where it's like Scenes from an Italian Abortion Clinic or something.
Well, but also the coda on all of this is like that abortion clinic on Bleecker Street was actually shut down, but not shut down because of the intense pro-life protest movement in New York City. It was shut down because of like budget cuts. And so I think that, again, that sort of points to the fact that I've never really participated in pro-life protests, but I just don't think that that's the mechanism by which things actually change here. And maybe that's very disheartening, because for a lot of people, that's, what they can commit to. But I just think judicial change, legislative change, or the power of prayer, which I know Nick will absolutely hate. The mechanisms by which we can change things.
All right. Speaking of New York, thing about the, I'm sorry to interrupt, Peter, but no, the other thing is that abortion issues or reproductive issues are different, because it's more like protesting porn in the 70s and 80s. When porn was happening in public theaters, there were protests against it. And even in my hometown in New Jersey, there were protests against the one, Pussycat Theater, which was not called that. It had a name like the Thalia or something kind of legitimate, or the Strand. When that stuff shifted into indoors,
they didn't call it a public goon cave.
No, they did not. But it's also like abortion now. you know, the vast majority of abortions take place at home. People are using pills and things like that. So it changes the place where you would protest or what you would do, because it's no longer a public issue in the same way that it was when, you know, you had to go out to watch porn.
All right. So on the topic of New York and budget cuts, we do need to move along. Here, we're getting to the end of the hour, and New York. I've got three New Yorkers on this podcast, and it really looks like pretty soon Zoran Mamdani, the socialist, is going to be the mayor of America's most important city. So I just want you all to give us one reason why people who are not New Yorkers should care about this. Matt Welch, let's start with you.
In 2019, I wrote a really long piece, way too long, for Reason.com, about the changes in admission standards in middle schools for districts in Brooklyn that I happen to live in and my daughter was going into middle school. And I had to do a big paragraph here, like, here's why anyone else should care about this article, because you're going to soon hear about in your school districts about equity and DEI and controlled choice admissions standards and a bunch of other nonsense, which starting very, very soon, way too many people actually did have to come in contact with, partly as a result of COVID. So that is the one reason. Most people don't need to know about this and don't need to obsess about it as part of their consumption. But Mamdani is about to win, probably handily, over two candidates. And he's going to do it after having run on making buses free freezing rents and taxing the rich, because the income tax that already exists in New York City apparently isn't high enough, even though most cities do not have income taxes. The question to watch is to see whether other Democratic politicians in the big city near you are going to be rubbing their hands and saying, yes, we're going to do free bus fares, because not even that it's going to work, because most of the things that Mamdani wants to do are not going to be something that he can do because of the just awful overlapping governance structures of New York. For instance, the state runs the buses. Who knows why? So it's not going to work, but it works well enough for a guy who tilts his head a lot and smiles to win an election. So that might mean that your local buses are going to soon become free. So that's why you should pay attention to the nonsense that he's saying and is going to be trying to deliver on as people with means figure out ways to live outside of the city walls for 183 days a year.
Also, Liz our Wolf. Buses are already free to like half the people who ride them, right?
Yeah, I mean, literally half.
Who rides buses? Come on.
I do.
Liz does.
I'd rather walk or ride a bike.
Liz Wolf, are you mainly concerned about the buses here? Is that why people who don't live in New York should care about the Mamdani victory?
No, I actually have a very freeing answer for those who are sick of hearing about New York, especially like through like my silly newsletter. No, I actually don't think you should care that much about Zoran Mamdani winning, which I think he's going to, because I think that there is sometimes the temptation in American politics to overweigh a one specific result. And I think that the main thing that this indicates, at least to me, is that like a lot of my neighbors are kind of economically illiterate and very privileged and sort of are interested in biting the hand that feeds. They're not.
Which neighborhood do you live in?
I now live in Clinton Hill in Brooklyn. I used to live in Sliwa territory in Rockaway Beach, Queens. But no, I mean, I do think it is important to not have the takeaway from this be, wow, there's a wave of democratic socialist candidates taking over the nation, or he really ran an economic policy oriented campaign. And that's the type of thing that other Democrats need to emulate nationally. Or, you know, the Democratic Party has really pivoted away from wokeness. I think any of these explanations are a little bit overly simplistic. And I think, honestly, the thing that I keep coming back to is conditions in New York in terms of cost of living, I think are pretty bad. But they're not so bad that we are actually willing to implement any sort of austerity, to expect better public services to be provided by our politicians, to expect to see more results for the amount of money our government is spending on our behalf. Things sort of haven't gotten bad enough to actually result in that wake-up call for some of my neighbors to actually begin to pay attention to the lessons of socialism and to take seriously the fact that you can drive rich people out of your city and then you're pretty effed. You know, in Argentina, we very much see the opposite case scenario where things did get bad enough that now people are interested in voting for Milei and staying the course. But I think, you know, to the extent that you can take away a lesson from Mamdani at all, It's just that New Yorkers remain relatively privileged and able to have the sort of very luxury belief of, you know, rich people are these people who we can just routinely denigrate over and over again with, you know, the expectation that they will always stick around and that we really don't owe them anything. They don't get a vote over what happens in our city. They don't get a say. And that anybody who's sort of agitating for improved city services, improved schools, gifted and talented programs to stick around, an end to the rent control and stabilization regime, all of those people are just stupid. I think the bite the hand that feeds mentality is going to result in bad things later on, but I don't think we're there yet.
Yeah, I mean, I take your point, but he is a rising star. He is in New York, which is the media capital, which means he's going to end up with a ton of coverage. And I think national Dems are going to look to him and going to think this guy won an upset victory, seems to be very popular, at least with the base. Maybe we need to take some lessons from him. Nick, what do you think the thing that non-New Yorkers should be paying attention to Mamdani's victory or likely victory if and when it happens?
You know, New York, by more than a factor of two, is the largest city in the country. And what happens in New York ends up bleeding into the rest of the country. New York passed the first pooper scooper law, which I think was a good law. I think it was a win for property rights, as well as for scat freaks like Matt Welch. But, you know, it made they could just walk around and broad daylight.
Tough times for Malay's dog walker.
But,
that's 500 pounds.
New York matters in a way that no other city in the country does because it is so big and it is paradigmatic. And I also think that's why many people are rooting for, outside of New York, are rooting for Mamdani to win and to New York, you know, for New York to descend into another 1970s where it lost about 10% of its population, largely due to terrible governance. I don't think he is going to, he's not the agent of the terrible governance. He's as much an effect as a cause of it. And we are in we're in about a 12-year cycle of bad governance, starting with the two de Blasio terms and Eric Adams. Mamdani will add to that, and it'll take another 20 years before you get back to a cycle of like an Ed Koch, a Giuliani, and a Bloomberg who bring the city back to where it's really going well. But I think that's the reason. But I agree with Liz. I wouldn't worry about it too much. The other thing, Peter, I'll say to you, if he's going to win, he's going to get a lot of press. The fight within the Democratic Party, though, I think is going to be found more in the gubernatorial races of New Jersey and Virginia, where you have more centrist Democrats running against, and particularly in the case of Virginia, to succeed a popular kind of centrist Republican. I think that's the action. If the Democrats win in both of those states, you're going to see a surge of kind of establishment centrist Democrats saying this is the plan going forward, not doing Mamdani, who is very much in the identity politics side and the far left side of Democratic governance.
Well, he's the alternative narrative in the world of the Democratic infighting that's happening to essentially the kind of moderate lane or even the abundance agenda. Yep. Had to bring that in there. All right, so let's go to our final segment. What have you been watching, reading, otherwise consuming in the cultural realm? I'll start. I watched the movie A House of Dynamite. It's about nuclear war and how it's terrifying, and we might not be very good at responding to it. It is a procedural in which a nuclear missile appears to go off. We track it. We're in the situation room, and we're like, oh, there's a nuclear... It is probably nothing. Oh, wait, maybe it's not nothing. Oh, where did this even come from? We don't know. What are we going to do? We got about 16, 17 minutes. And then the movie just unfurls from there. What do you do? And not just what do you do, but who is making the decisions? And this movie is really interesting because part of what it does is it shows you that every person down the chain of decision making, from the president to all of these sort of senior staffers, the kind of top defense officials, they're all human beings with personal lives. They've got kids. Sometimes they have dentist appointments. Sometimes they have been up all night. They're distracted. They're thinking about the game and who won last night. And they're not really focused on this whole thing where there's a nuclear missile bearing down on, looks like, the Midwestern United States. And so it is this fascinating, terrifying, nightmare-inducing procedural about what might happen if a nuclear weapon is actually fired, maybe in anger, and especially if we don't have imperfect information, which seems like it is probably going to be the case. And then we will have 18, 19, maybe 20 minutes at most to make possibly the most consequential decisions that any human beings have ever made in their lives. It is absolutely terrifying, kind of riveting. I think some people didn't love the ending, which people have said is a cop-out. It doesn't quite tell you exactly how it is all resolved. But this isn't a movie that is interested in resolving things and sort of showing you the kind of full length of, you know, of a war and the revenge and giving you that satisfaction in, say, a Tom Clancy-like way. What it wants to do is remind you all of these decision makers, even the ones who are good at heart, who are smart people, who are trying to do the right thing, they're just ordinary people operating within a flawed system and not nearly information. And when that moment comes, boy, you better hope that they make the right decision. It's by Catherine Bigelow, who directed Point Break, among other things, as well as The Hurt Locker and a couple of other things she's just this great sort of tough lady director, was married to James Cameron for a while. Her initial student short film was just two dudes beating the crap out of each other while there was narration about like masculinity and like deconstructing the masculine ideal. So she's always been very concerned with boys and their toys and the dangers of male violence. This is another movie along those lines. Just great. It's on Netflix, A House of Dynamite. I'm not sure I quite recommend it, but it's a pretty compelling piece of filmmaking. Liz Wolfe, what do you have for us?
I have been rewatching the 2020 10 episode series, The Last Dance, that follows Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls as they attempt to secure their, I think it was, what is it, their sixth NBA title over the course of eight seasons in the fall of 1997. But the thing that I've been paying the most attention to upon this rewatch of this excellent documentary series is just the degree to which the coach of the Bulls, Phil Jackson, kind of took Dennis Rodman, like the craziest guy on the team, just like absolutely like multiple screws loose in the head, just took him under his wing and I think saw such potential in him, saw just extraordinary energy and work ethic, and managed to kind of tease that out of him to make Dennis Rodman the sort of perfect third for Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen. And then just, I think, knew how to manage him so beautifully such that, you know, Dennis Rodman would go on these 48-hour plus benders in Las Vegas at these like absolutely critical moments and, you know, just engage in all kinds of antics. And Jackson, I think, did such a good job of knowing when to just trust him and when to just let it kind of happen and recognize that it's like the way to manage a tempestuous personality like that is just to believe that their sort of like inner voice will bring them back home. And in the end, and that is what happened with Dennis Rodman. He didn't want to disappoint the people who vouched for him and who believed in him. But I also think Phil Jackson, just like in general, is kind of a cool character. He's like very in touch with Native American spirituality and like an extremely Zen dude. And I just find his integration of those types of practices into the training of the Chicago Bulls to be kind of awesome. And just an underexplored, underappreciated guy. Just a huge Phil Jackson fan over here. Huge Dennis Rodman fan too. He like tried to get, I guess, Madonna and him had some sort of deal allegedly where he was going to like impregnate her. And then he traveled to the Vatican during a papal conclave because he was just like a huge John Paul II fan and just like felt like he needed to be there. I don't know. Guy just has good instincts and good hair and good piercings. What can I say?
And this was before he solved the North Korea nuclear threat?
That is true.
Yeah, I think this was before his little his dalliance. I mean, what can I say? I like a problematic figure.
Matt Welch, speaking of problematic figures, I think you also have some basketball content for us.
In fact, yeah, the Michael Jordan tie-in too. I watched the this sounds like a weird thing to recommend, and it is, maybe, NBC, the National Broadcasting Broadcast Corporation, I always forget, has taken over the contract to broadcast NBA games for the first time in a quarter century. And so they posted this kind of teaser trailer thing at the beginning of their season, which was last week, I believe. And it's this 3-minute long thing, and they play the music again, and they show like a bunch of 90s stuff, and 90s stuff just means Michael Jordan. And they're playing definitely off the nostalgia of people mine and Nick's age. And then they do a really clever twist, which is that they interview a bunch of stars, or just little clips from interviews of current stars, and ask them what they remember about the glory days of 1990s NBC, NBA stuff. And of course, most of them were not born, and they're just kind of fumbling around and making comical answers about the stuff that they don't have any connection with whatsoever, which I like because I hate nostalgia. And I think anti-nostalgia is also kind of interesting. But our friend Ethan Strauss, who writes a really great Substack about sports, House of Strauss, had a piece about this talking about the difference of approach with NBC, just an old network, and the way they broadcast games, and ESPN, which had it forever. And it's a difference of like taking an asset and saying, how do we make this thing an event? How do we show more kind of like spotlight on the players and the game? Whereas ESPN is like, how do we like get little chunks out of the asset and use that to cross promote maximally and just kind of denigrate it? And I think there's something to that. Apparently, I didn't watch game two of the World's Baseball World Series except for the ninth inning. But in the middle of the game, they do this stupid thing and have been doing for like 20 years, where they just decide to get everybody in the building to wear pink and hold up a sign saying that they stand up against cancer. And now, granted,
breast cancer, Matt, breast cancer.
I don't want breast cancer to keep its ravaging.
You're like Kodak Black.
The world. I'm not objectively pro-cancer.
This is a very strong stand. Big take here. Wasn't expecting this one.
Really out on a limb.
And apparently in game two, they did the same thing, which I always hate, thankfully didn't see. But then they added a new Jonas Brothers song. The Jonas Brothers came on the field in the middle of a baseball game and debuted their new song. It's just like, let's take the asset and absolutely spoil it for everybody and denigrate it and try to do some cross-promotional tie-in. That is what people have been using sports broadcasting for a long time. And I think it's really clever to not do it that way, to actually, you know, the human drama of athletic competition and treat that with the reverence and respect that it deserves for its audience, rather than crap it all up with those gambling ads, Nick Gillespie.
I think, and I have in my pocket a sports documentary that I'll talk about in a second, but ESPN's genius, Matt Welch, and I suspect you will agree with this, at least for its first, 100 years, was that it did not take sports so seriously, where they would make fun of these obvious blockheaded, lantern-jawed idiots. And instead of taking Mickey Mantle as like, a Greek god, they would just have fun in a super fan way where you love sports. I loved watching ESPN, but it opened it up where it's like, oh, yeah. And, when these people are idiots and stupid or do something incredibly blockheaded, you would point that out. And that's what made ESPN the first great sports network. Because you didn't have to listen to these old farts talking about, the quality of the ash wood that they use in baseball bats and, Honus Wagner or something, Matt.
But no, it's more for me. They became great because they would, when everyone was just sports starved at a certain part of the year, they would play Australian rules football. And you go, all right, whatever. Let's have it.
ESPN the Ocho, right?
Jet ski competitions, things like that. So I watched a documentary also on Netflix that was is called Who Killed the Montreal Expos? And it is directed by a Quebecois.
Is it a murder mystery?
Jean-Francois Poisson.
No.
I wanted to watch this movie because the Montreal Expos were a franchise that started in 1967 and they ended in the early 2000s when they got transmogrified into the Washington Nationals. And I wanted to see a bunch of old Expos players, who are great, none of whom really spent most of their great years with the Expos. But Montreal had a great baseball heritage because there was a AAA team that Jackie Robinson played on, the Montreal Royals. And it was supposedly a great baseball loving team. But instead of showing us actual footage of people like Pedro Martinez, Gary Carter, Tim Raines, Andre Dawson, Vlad Guerrero, Dennis Martinez, El Presidente, Larry Walker, Randy Johnson, it was a bunch of people bitching and moaning about the fact that the Expos ended up losing their franchise, despite the fact that they only had 6 years where they had attendance that was above the major league average.
Playing in the worst stadium in the history of baseball.
Two of the worst stadiums in baseball history. And this is where it gets interesting. There were new owners who, well, yeah, that's true. They made some play of Jupi, who is the worst mascot in the history of baseball, but they didn't even mention his more retarded predecessor, Suki, who was there for 1 year. They don't even show him or mention him. And I think it was him. I don't know. But what happened was, The Quebec government wouldn't publicly finance a stadium, and the carpetbagger owners, and all baseball owners are carpetbaggers, ended up selling the team to Major League Baseball, and then it got changed to the Nationals, and the owners and the president of the Expos ended up with the Marlins, where they actually won a World Series again in a couple of years and then strip mined the team. But this could have been a fascinating kind of documentary about a middling market team that should have had a much bigger audience, because Montreal is one of the biggest cities in North America, has a baseball tradition. And the government wisely said, no, we are not going to subsidize your bullshit stadium. And instead, it just became, a bunch of people, not even on the baseball field, arguing about why a sports franchise left a city like Montreal. So I can't recommend it, but I did watch it with interest all the way to the end. And I gave it, Peter, on Netflix, you can either give it a thumbs down, one thumb up, or two thumbs up if you really like it. I give this a thumb up. So Jean-Francois Poisson, this fish stunk from the head.
I guess we're all going to have to log in and find your Letterboxd review if we want to know more.
Yes.
Okay, folks, that is our show. But before we go, Nick, do you have any events you want to tell us about happening in the great city of New York?
Yeah, the greatest city in the country until Mamdani wins, of course, and then instantly the lights go out all over Broadway.
For another
on
week.
Wednesday at the Village Underground, which is part of the Comedy Cellar group of clubs in Greenwich Village, we're doing a live screening of a great Reason documentary by Justin Zuckerman, which is about rent control and rent stabilization and how it degrades not just the quantity but the quality of housing, and how that's likely to play out under a Mamdani or even an Andrew Cuomo mayoral election. And then we're going to have a panel with Howard Cusack, who's a longtime historian of housing, of public housing in particular, but of housing in general, and the Manhattan Institute's John Ketchum, who has written brilliantly about rent stabilization. This event is co-sponsored by Reason and the Manhattan Institute, but if you go to reason.com/events, you can still get tickets. It's going to be great. There'll also be an after party somewhere nearby. Matt is going to buy a bunch of malt liquor, and we'll head over to Washington Square Park.
And I guess that's all right.
reason.com/events. Don't miss it. Don't miss it.
Yeah. All right. Zuckerman's great. His movies are just excellent. Really sharp filmmaker. Also worked for Family Guy for a while. As always, if you like this podcast, you can support us by going to reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. Thank you all so much for listening to the very, very end here. The Reason Roundtable will return.